And he joins me now to talk about season two of Intelligence. He is none other than Nick Muhammad. Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks, Brad. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to talk to you because, first of all, love the show. Show is great. This first season was great. Second season, I think, took it to another level. Streaming now on Peacock. I guess I wanted to start there, though. It's the second season. So you write, create Intelligence. First season goes off well. And when you got the word, okay, we're doing a second season, as the writer, did you have the Larry David effect of how the hell am I going to come up with another season of this show? Or did you already have an idea of where you wanted to go after season one wrapped?
Well, we were quite lucky in that we found out quite soon off the back of delivering season one that we knew that we were going to be doing a season two, which was handy just because, you know, I'd had some ideas and stuff, but it meant that I could sort of get going with it quite soon and, you know, solve any little sort of mini cliffhangers that were kind of left hanging in season one. So we had the luxury, and, you know, with the pandemic, sadly, you know, we had a luxury of a little bit more time as well. So we, so I sort of felt very excited about going into season two. And I think just knowing, you know, apart from Shrim, who plays Jerry, and obviously Jane Stanis, who plays Mary, and I've worked with both of them before, but everyone else we cast for season one. So it was nice, you know, we were such a lovely unit off the back of, you know, working together on season one, knowing everyone's voices and everyone's strengths and what dynamics work well. It was a real like joy to like start writing season two with all their voices kind of, you know, in my head and knowing what they would be able to bring to it.
You know, that's actually a great thing that I wanted to ask you about when you talk about having to write in season two, you're writing with their voices in mind. In season one, you're literally putting words of dialogue on a page and you have it in your head how you want it to go. But then when you get on set, is it difficult for you as the writer to have to hear actors deliver your dialogue in a way that maybe you didn't intend for it to be delivered?
Occasionally, you know, an actor might do a slightly different interpretation, but often, you know, we'll discuss things. You know, I really enjoy being collaborative and particularly, you know, we had a casting process. So, you know, we chose the people who we thought were kind of right for the part, you know, who could do the script justice, but also we want someone who can sort of bring their own thing to it as well. And Silvestre Latuzzo, who plays Christine, is a great example of that because she absolutely owns that part in a way that, you know, no one else does. And you know, I now really write that part up as, you know, give her so many words to say in one breath. You know, she's a real kind of captain of the ship of that outfit. And so it's, you know, it's always a joy. And just occasionally I'll have to, you know, not explain a joke, but there'll be an intention behind a particular line, which, you know, I'll remind the actor of, or they'll either do their own spin on it and we'll discuss which is best. And sometimes we'll shoot alternatives and they'll improvise another line which might be better or whatever. So yeah, it's got, by the time we get to set, you know, because the script's always in good shape by that point, we sort of try and let everyone have fun with it.
So you don't mind as the writer if they want to, like you said, improv the line or come up with something better at the time when you're feeling the scene out? You don't mind that at all?
No, not really. And it depends. I mean, occasionally it depends if we're doing like a, you know, like a lot of those boardroom scenes, there's sort of 5-6 people in the room and it's sort of pinging around the room and they're quite difficult to film. And there's a particular rhythm that, you know, you kind of need to generate for those scenes to really flow. And often we'll try and limit improv for those scenes just because we just know how much we have to pick up the, you know, in the edit, just sort of going from person to person. But often if it's a two-hander, three-hander, we'll try and allow for a little bit of play because, you know, some really nice stuff can come off the back of that. And, you know, a lot of those casts are great improvisers and can add to scenes, stuff that, you know, you would never think of as a writer.
So let me ask you, when you were writing the show, if I have this correct, you were writing the part that David Schwimmer plays with him in mind specifically. Is that right?
Very much so, yeah.
So okay, you were writing it for him, but he plays kind of this kind of alpha, I own the room, my ego takes up whatever, you know, building it inhabits at the time. But David Schwimmer, to me, when I think of him, that's not the first actor who comes to my head for a role like that. So why was Schwimmer, in your mind, the right guy for this part and you were writing for him specifically?
Well, that was why it felt quite exciting, because it was so kind of against type that so David and I had met. I'd written a pilot with Julia Davis, a UK pilot that didn't get picked up in the end, but David had seen it and had enjoyed it, and he ended up getting in contact with us, and we did some sort of workshops with him and did some improv, and we knew that we quite enjoyed, you know, and one of the things that we did where he played this quite brash American, you know, very sort of prototype to Jerry in Intelligence, and I knew that I just really loved sort of hearing him swear, hearing him have his really right opinion, you know, the anti-Ross from Friends, really. And so once I knew I'd got the commission and that, you know, Schwimm had agreed to kind of come on board, you know, it was an absolute shoo-in to just kind of really write that part, you know, really play into the stuff that we're not used to seeing him do.
Yeah, because it really, even from his introductory scene in season one, it really sets the tone of, this is not a David Schwimmer that you've seen on camera before. You know, it's not him playing Robert Kardashian. It's not him playing Ross from Friends. He has a real feel to it. And I just think it was a really great idea to have him and to have that juxtaposition of what we think of him as. And then he completely, you know, kills that image of Ross in this show. You don't think of Ross one time. I'm sure that's probably was a bit of a fear, right? Like, these guys, are they just going to look at him as the character that they know him as, or?
I think that, I mean, David was really excited about, you know, he's, you know, he had, obviously he's super proud of Friends and everything, but, you know, he was really excited at the prospect of playing, you know, taking people by surprise a little bit. And, you know, we really wrote that part up with all of that in mind. But yeah, I mean, there's an element of risk because, I mean, particularly Friends, it's such a well-loved show, and, you know, everyone loves Ross and knows Ross and knows his qualities. And, you know, I guess people watching Intelligence, if they enjoyed Friends, it might not necessarily be that they're going to necessarily enjoy Intelligence, you know. So there was always that to play with, but you can only ever write what you find funny. And, you know, it was very collaborative with David as well. So we felt that we were kind of doing the right thing. And, you know, we don't want to just see him doing the same thing again, I guess.
Right. And when you have him in the show, obviously, you know, there's going to be a big appeal from an American audience, given, you know, who he is in the States. And I mean, Friends was worldwide, but obviously it was massive in the States as it was everywhere else. When you're writing the show and the dialogue, do you have to think about writing it for, I don't know, almost an audience of two countries in a way, just with certain dialogue? Is like, well, would an American audience know what I'm talking about here? Or was that a worry of you at all?
A little bit. I would always write it the way I wanted to write it, or, you know, with a particular joke. And then, you know, we have obviously, Peacock obviously streamed the show. So, and Tom Hodges, who's an exec on the show, who's David's business partner, and David's an exec on the show as well. So we kind of, there was enough of an American arm to it, you know, with an eye on the scripts as well. So if we needed to tweak a line so that the joke would read both sides of the Atlantic, we would do. It's similar to Ted Lasso in a way, you know, American writers will write stuff for British actors, and, you know, we'll occasionally put it into our voice or put it into our sort of regional dialect, you know, just to make it feel right. Because occasionally there are certain cadences or rhythms that don't work, you know, both sides of the Atlantic. But that wasn't too big an issue, really.
So GCHQ being the backdrop, I mean, when I think of a workplace sitcom, you think of, I don't know, The Office, Parks and Rec, even News Radio, if you want to go back a little bit, but kind of small stakes, very low stakes jobs that these people have. GCHQ, you're talking about national security. You're talking about the most high risk job you can have. Why was that the idea for you, of that being the backdrop of this workplace comedy?
Well, I'd always wanted to write a workplace comedy. You know, I'm a huge fan of those shows, Parks and Rec, The Office, The American Office. You know, I love all those shows. And I think that's what I found, the base note of, like, this group of sort of misfits, you know, leading their humdrum lives and not very good at sort of social interaction. They're quite awkward. They're all a bit sort of geeky in their own way. But, you know, the fact that they are the people who, you know, sort of stand between us and, you know, this huge backdrop of national security, the fact that they're in charge, I found that, you know, just the sort of the base note to the whole series, that these are the people who are, you know, saving all mankind, as it were, humankind. I just found that inherently funny. And yeah, it's fun to have effectively a workplace sitcom, but with such big stakes. And you know, it's quite, you know, weirdly, it's obviously just quite true. You know, a lot of the stuff that features in the show, especially the second series, Eternal Blue, this cyber weapon, is based on a real cyber weapon that has been used to cause, you know, wreak havoc across the globe. And, you know, cyber crime and cyber terrorism is sort of the new frontier of, you know, a lot of bad stuff. So it was sort of, you know, it was kind of not topical because it's not a satire as such, but you know, it felt like I was writing sort of real about real events, but you know, you've got these really odd people kind of sort of at the helm, which I'm, you know, I'm not saying that's what GCHQ is like by any means, but it's fun to imagine it being like that.
Yeah, I think it'd be a fun place if GCHQ was like that. But season two, obviously, of Intelligent streaming right now on Peacock. Can we talk about magic for a second?
Yeah.
Because I know that you're a magician yourself. Where did that fascination come from? When did you start performing and practicing magic?
Well, I got into it when I was really young, like a kid, seeing a show over here called the Paul Daniels Magic Show. But he's sadly passed away 5 years ago. But he was a brilliant British magician called Paul Daniels. Had a big Saturday night TV show. Millions watched it, and I loved it. And I was hooked. And he would kind of compare the night, but he would have international acts and close-up performers. And I was absolutely was hooked. And my sister got a magic set from our auntie when she was like 7 or 8, and I must have been 4. I kind of stole it and just loved it and performed. Yeah, you know, I started really, you know, I just then practiced. I got into the junior section of the Northern Magic Circle when I was around 12, 13. But then as soon as I could properly work, you know, as soon as I turned 16, I was kind of, you know, working in hotels and restaurants. And, you know, it's how I paid a lot of, you know, my way through university as well, doing a lot of the kind of college events and so on. So I worked as a magician for a while. But then, yeah, and you know, there was a slight kind of comedy edge to some of the magic, but yeah, it sort of slowly kind of morphed into, you know, I started then when I was started doing stand-up or kind of character stand-up and stuff, I would occasionally put magic into it because it was sort of a fail set, you know, it was kind of a bit of a safety net, but gradually the magic sort of dwindled away. And I still, you know, I still read about magic. I've literally just bought a magic book by my new book, massive 2-volume set of new sort of mentalism-y sort of stuff. And so I still reading and you know, practicing magic, but I would say I'm more of a hobbyist now. I'm still showing friends and family, boring them to tears still with it. But yeah, I don't do it professionally as much anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same fascination when I was growing up. I took, I don't know, a few, maybe a year or two of magic lessons myself, but I never got past like cups and balls and some SpongeBob routines, coin palms, some yeah, card tricks and things of that nature. What were your go-tos? What would you like to, like if someone was like, hey, give me your best tricks, what were the first ones you'd go to?
Cards are always a good one because, you know, I enjoy a lot of kind of recently quite a lot of hands-off cards magic, which is more sort of think of a card, here's a deck, you know, you shuffle, think of a number, deal down to that number, there's your card. Like a lot of kind of that. I love sort of quite straightforward magic. I was never because I'm quite short and I've got small hands, I was never as good at kind of card manipulation or any of the really technical stuff. So I would have to rely on a lot of kind of mental stuff, a lot of mathematical stuff, self-working stuff with minimal sleight of hand. But you know, I'm a bit more adept now. But cups and balls, I love doing a chop cup routine, which is the one with just the single cup rather than the three cups. God, what do I do? That's funny. I've never really talked about it in as much detail. I enjoy, yeah, I've got, you know, I've got all the stuff you were saying, sponge balls I do to my kids, coin stuff. But I like mentalism. You know, a lot of people have, particularly in the UK, there's a very famous mentalist over here called Darren Brown. A lot of the magic community have now become sort of mentally, you know, really into the kind of mind reading-y side of magic, which I still, you know, is fascinating and brilliant. I don't know if I'd have the guts to perform some of it, but yeah, I love it. You know, lots of it I love.
Yeah, I studied mentalism for a little bit, but I just, like you said, going out there to perform it, there's so many things that can go wrong when you're doing mentalism magic that, you know, I don't know if it's worth the risk if you're not, you know, as you said, some of these masters of it.
Well, there's a lot of, with mentalism, it's same with like escapology, I guess, you know, so much of the process is part of the act. You know, you can't, if someone thinks of something, it sort of, it feels a bit too neat to just be like, and you're thinking of that straight away. It feels like there should be a process, so they've got to concentrate and you start to sort of sketch the idea that they're thinking, you know, but you know, if you then get it wrong after that 5-minute build-up or whatever, or if there's an escapologist, you fail to escape after struggling for 10 minutes, you know, it's the same kind of thing. So yeah, you have to be a bit ballsy, I think, to kind of go out and do it.
So I love studying people who I think were just expert in their craft. And Johnny Carson, you know, longtime host of The Tonight Show, somebody I love. He had impeccable timing as a host, an interviewer, a comedian. But he also did magic. That's how he started in the entertainment world. He was the great Carsoni, and he would do all kinds of little small magic shows. And I just wonder, do you think there's a link there between the timing of a magician and the timing of a comedian? Do you think that your work in magic has helped you at all with that?
Possibly. I don't know. I mean, there are definitely a lot of Steve Martin started off as a magician. I mean, Jason Sudeikis is a brilliant magician. I think to a degree, sometimes I think magic is or can be a lot easier than comedy, because I think, you know, it is possible nowadays to order a magic trick off the internet, read the instructions or watch the YouTube link, and it's like a thing that you pretty much press a button and it will work. And you could feasibly, not suggesting this is good, but you could feasibly go to a paid gig and perform that at a wedding and the trick would work and an audience would be like, oh great, the trick's worked. Whereas I think as a comedian, you know, even if you'd learnt a joke or you'd learnt an anecdote which has got a funny, you know, to deliver it, to have the timing and the, you know, to sort of really allow your personality to shine through a kind of comedy set feels like a lot more difficult and, you know, requires more experience. But I'm sure there are absolutely transferable skills, and, you know, just in terms of having the confidence to perform, which I did sort of through magic as I was growing up, that then definitely gave me confidence to perform on stage doing comedy, or, you know, on set acting. And so, you know, there is an element of just, you know, being the center of attention, that you know, you become comfortable being the center of attention for, you know, a moment or a small moment. And that is true of being a magician or an actor or comedian or whatever. You know, people are focused on you for a particular reason and you have to deliver the goods. And so that sort of side of it, you know, I can see that being useful.
Okay, that's an interesting take. You mentioned Jason Sudeikis and obviously Ted Lasso, we talked about a minute ago. When I saw the trailers for Ted Lasso, I said, oh, that looks like a funny show. Then when I watched the show, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like a brilliant comedy that I didn't really see. When you think about the concept, it could be really, you know, goofy and cartoony maybe, right? You could have really leaned strong into that, but it's such a really smart, funny comedy. How do you feel about, you know, the show itself, and how did you kind of become a part of that one?
Hey, it's a wonderful show. I mean, it is, you know, and it's been, you know, absolute joy to be a part of it. And, you know,
so good.
Connected with, you know, audiences across the world, really, and at a time when I feel that people did need a really positive, hopeful show given, you know, the pandemic and everything. And I think it's funny because, yeah, you know, on the face of it, it could be like, you know, a sports movie condensed into a TV serial or something, but yeah, it's a lot more than that. And I think the characters feel believable. I think that, you know, even Ted Lasso, you know, is, it can be quite goofy and fun and has these great one-liners, but he's got so much heart and depth as well. And he's struggling with his, you know, a failed marriage and being in touch with his son. You know, there's a lot of like real heartfelt emotion like across that show, and I think that's a trick that they've managed to do. They've managed to create this really funny show that honors the sport as well, for sports fans, you know, for people who are into it because of, you know, the fact that it's about football or soccer or whatever. And but equally, these characters all have depth and are able to kind of resonate with an audience in different ways. And so, yeah, it's, I you know, when I just cast for it, you know, it was an audition that had come through, and I knew the, you know, Jason's work and Bill Lawrence as well. And in fact, Brendan Hunt, one of the co-creators as well, he'd seen one of my shows up in the Edinburgh Festival like years ago. And so I was familiar with it, but I very much had to, you know, I auditioned for Higgins first, Jeremy Swift's part, and didn't get that. And then there was a bit of a break, and then they asked me to cast again for it and to do Nate. And I was busy with Intelligence, filming season one of Intelligence at the time. So I had to like rush doing it in my lunch break and thought, oh, you know, this might not lead to anything. And yeah, I was sort of gobsmacked, and it did. And yeah, it's just been a wonderful show to be a part of. And yeah, season two's out very soon. And yeah, you know, I'm nervous for season two to come out in a way, because I'm really excited, because I think I honestly do think it's somehow they managed to go head and shoulders above season one. But I, you know, because season one did go so well, there is that nervous anticipation of thinking, oh God, I hope people like it. Because, you know, there is that, you know, people have taken it to heart. And, you know, even Nate, that character and his particular journey in season one, it's a really sweet, you know, the underdog succeeding story, and everyone can relate to that and they like that. The season two journey, without giving anything away, is completely different. And yeah, it'll be just interesting seeing how people react to all that.
Well, you know what? I'm sure you had a similar feeling before season two of Intelligence came out and you crushed it. I think you took the show to the next level with season two. I mean, season one was great. I like season two a little bit more. That's just my personal opinion. I'm sure Ted Lasso, you too. Okay, well, that's good. So we agree. We agree. And I'm sure Ted Lasso will do the same. But it's been a pleasure to talk to you today, Nick. I really enjoyed it. Make sure everybody go out there and watch season two, streaming now of Intelligence on Peacock. Nick, thanks so much, man.
Thanks so much, Brad. Thanks for having me.